I'm Christopher Leiden at the Key West Literary Seminar, Winter 2013, on the southern tip of Florida, where Ernest Hemingway did his greatest work in the 1930s, where artists and writers love to gather and gab in the tropical sun. The theme of the seminar this year is Writers on Writers. I'm their straight man. First up with me, in conversation before 500 guests, is the wayward and very funny Englishman, Jeff Dyer. He's an essayist on everything, including jazz, photography, D.H. Lawrence, and his living idol, the aesthete John Berger. You are not allowed not to like Jeff Dyer. Here we go. Jeff Dyer, since he got here, has been hustling tennis games and ping pong games. I don't know how he's doing enlisting people into this trap, but this is our tennis game. He's never seen my serve before. I don't know about his backhand, but nobody will get hurt. I'm a great admirer. The other thing I just wanted to say at the outset was that I woke up the other morning thinking, this is obvious. Jeff Dyer is the man I want to be when I grow up. And I say that not entirely in jest. It began with a wonderful book he wrote maybe 15 years ago called But Beautiful. It was about American jazz, not his native language exactly, but people I felt I knew very, very well, starting with the wonderful Harry Carney, who was the baritone saxophone player in Duke Ellington's band. And as a lot of people knew, he was Duke's driver all over the country through the middle of the night. The rest of the band went on the bus, but Jeff had imagined conversations between Harry Carney and Duke in the middle of the night, all surrounding extraordinarily imaginative, but in strange ways, authoritative profiles of Chet Baker, Bud Powell, Lester Young, and others. It's an extraordinary book, followed by many extraordinary books, in which the thread, it seems to me, is the kind of, not exactly, certainly not institutional, but imaginative authority of Jeff Dyer, who does not seem to recognize aesthetic boundaries or human limitations, but the moral of so much he's written about photography, about painting, about aesthetics in general, about poetry, literature, the American Southwest, his haircuts, his ping pong game, Southeast Asia, Indonesia. The moral I take is that he wants to be the man, as Henry James said, on whom nothing is lost. This is all one giant human opportunity to press our nose to the window of life and take it all in to the extent we can, and not come out with giant dicta, but with a sense that we've tried it all. Does that sound anything like you?
Well, not surprisingly, my wife has a slightly different take on things. That Henry James line, which I'm very fond of, you know, one on whom nothing is lost, there was this moment, I remember it very clearly, when she said, I don't know how you do it. And I thought, great, I'm always ready for some sort of testament to the infinite mysteries of artistic creation. And she said, it's because, you know, I think, I can't remember where we were, she said, because, you know, you're not able to make anything up, you're not able to invent anything, and yet at the same time, you don't notice anything either. She would say, I'm one on whom everything is lost.
Well, as long as everything is lost equally. To me, you're a great challenge, Jeff, to bring a human authority to things, not an institutional or an academic or even scholarly authority, but like the human perspective that could be not uniform, but universal. You will notice in the bookstore in the lobby that Out of Sheer Rage is out of stock until tomorrow. And the reason is simply, it's Jeff's book about his adventures writing a sort of book about D.H. Lawrence that never quite got finished, but it raised all the interesting questions, and it's been a touchstone. The reason it sold out is that it was a touchstone for so many conversations about life and work, artists and writers, biographers and subjects, but also a distinction, which I think is critical, between biographers as sort of detectives, medicine cabinet investigators, searchers, historians, etc. And then another class of writers on writers who, the writers who are inhabited by writers, whether they write books about them or not, but in the sense that Colm Tobin, who has written about Henry James, but is, Henry James is somehow inside him, or he in Henry James, or Graham Greene inside Pico Iyer, or Walt Whitman inside Mark Doty. These relationships are infinitely mysterious. But I wanted to ask you, Jeff, if you just go back over that ground a little bit. I think it was Phyllis Rose who said at the outset your book on Lawrence was more about you, or all about you,
yeah,
and not about Lawrence. I could feel you bristling. Bristle away, or just review that bidding.
Sure. Well, yeah, so there's this book which sort of exists in different incarnations according to who reads it. So in some ways, I think in a, it's interesting with these seminars. So, yeah, it's writers on writers, but there's a subtext, of course, here, which Blake really brought out so brilliantly this morning, writers who can't write, and or writers who are no longer able to write. And that's, out of sheer rage, has become this kind of, people often praise it as a book about writer's block. And a couple of things here. I mean, one, I don't believe in writer's block in a way. It's funny because, I mean, I've gone through long periods of not writing, but it's not because of a blockage, which always has this sort of lavatorial connotation, doesn't it? You've got something in there, but you just can't get it out. I've gone through phases of not writing because I haven't had anything to say. That's one thing about writer's block. The other thing is that although that book sets up this idea that, you know, I, at the beginning, I want to write a serious academic book about D.H. Lawrence and it's all about my failure to, it was never going to be a straightforward academic book about Lawrence. That was always just a joke. That was always just a MacGuffin or whatever to get the book going. No point writing a sort of biography of Lawrence because Lawrence has been so well served by biographers. You know, there's that great three-volume Cambridge biography, which really tells you everything he did. And then in terms of a sense of what it was like to be with Lawrence on a day-to-day basis, you've got the incredibly vivid biography by Brenda Maddox. And, of course, this is the charge that's always made. I mean, one of the reasons that her portrait of Lawrence is so vivid is because it's perhaps not entirely reliable on a documentary level. Anyway, the nice thing about that is it meant all the donkey work, if that's not unbelievably insulting to the great biographers here, had been done. And I was free, since I've never had any ability to convey facts or information. I struggle with dates. I lack all the essential qualities of being a biographer. Anyway, it meant I was free to just write the kind of book I could write, which is a crazy book. A lot of it is about me. But the thing is, and this is where, it's great, Phyllis isn't here this week, so I can settle all sorts of scores with her. whereby, you know, it's all this, a lot of the stuff that's about me is a kind of, you know, reflection of Lawrence. So, for example, you know, the indecision, the irascibility, the impatience, you know, this isn't just me, or that's an aspect of my, of the persona that I amped up because it told us something about Lawrence. So, you know, for, you know, I've always, but my, I grew up with these, my parents were incredibly slow, lovely people. We'd go on these road trips and we'd always get over, cars would always pass us. And my mum would always say, whenever we were overtaken, as we call it in England, "Ooh, he's in a hurry." And I remember thinking, I'd love to be in a hurry once in my life. So that's a personal thing of mine. But also, you know, we think of Lawrence, you know, who said, you know, "When I was young, I had very little patience. And now I'm older, I have absolutely none at all." So, okay, there's a kind of mirroring going on there. Okay, and there's lots of knockabout comedy. But there's a serious literary critical point going on in that book as well, which is to say that Lawrence, whose reputation has never really recovered from the kicking that Kate Millett gave him in the 70s, I think he's a really, really great writer still. But I don't think that Lawrence's greatness lies for me now, on those canonical works that I read at university. So I, you know, now I would have trouble getting through Women in Love or The Rainbow. Weirdly for me, the places where Lawrence Adarita is at his freshest, they're in things like, well, not the novels, but in the travel books, which I think are amazing, because he has this extraordinary responsiveness to place. In the poems, and these are not poems in the sort of carefully crafted sort of Billy Collins, Mark Doty kind of mode. They're just, a poem for Lawrence would be something he would just dash off while he was waiting for a bus or something. Or just the essays he would do, short stories. So weirdly, and then best of all, I mean, for me, if you want to see Lawrence at his greatest, it's in the letters. So weirdly, what you get there, I think, is that pretty straightforward inversion of the classic hierarchy of genre, you know, that, yeah, so it's that, it's, you know, Lawrence, in a way, the writer of postcards, the jotter down of thoughts, rather than Lawrence as the, you know, as the novelist or the prophet of sexual revolution, you know, with, you know, the river of dissolution and the loins of darkness. You know, that strange part of the body, the loin, it seems to be weirdly non-corporeally specific. It seems to move around. And then with that, you see also, when Lawrence was writing, you know, the novel, which was where it was at. So you get, you know, it's, you know, Lawrence and Joyce, the two great sort of, you know, two great novelists who, surprise, surprise, shared an incredibly low opinion of each other's work. Joyce, you know, read a bit of, I think, one of the books and said, you know, that man really writes rather badly. And Lawrence had a very quick look at Ulysses and said, ah, just as I thought, a biblical stew of quotations with the cross turned upside down. Anyway, so, but it seems to me now that, you know, to repeat something I'm always blowing on about, the novel was the real proving ground, the only proving ground back then. Now it seems to me actually a lot of the stuff can go on in these other more marginal kind of genres. One outstanding example of which is, it so happens, my book on D.H. Lawrence.
Amen. I was just thinking, walking over this morning, I forget whether it was Thoreau or Emerson, it must have been Emerson speaking of an occult relationship with Thoreau. Of course, they knew each other very well. They walked, they reviewed each other's work. Do you feel an occult relationship with D.H. Lawrence?
Well, no, really. But I mean, I'm one of those writers. I'm not crazy about spending money. I mean, that's unusual, isn't it? But I did buy, you know, I forked out on a letter by D.H. Lawrence. Hmm. I mean, there's an unbelievable amount. If you look at if I could translate the amount I paid for this letter in terms of the number of words in the letter, if I could get paid that kind of rate per word, it would be fantastic. So I own this relic, you know, and it has a kind of religious sort of thing. There it is, this, it also has great sentiment. I mean, it's a letter from the later days of his life, when he was spending much more of his time painting than writing. And there's a great line of it. He says something like, you know, I like painting more. He says, it takes far less out of the soul than writing. Well, it's sort of true, but of course, if you were a painter, you might say, yeah, paintings like that take less out of the soul than writing. But anyway, so it's, yeah, and there's nobody else who I'd like to have a letter from. But it's also, it's this talismanic thing, because, I mean, I don't want to blar on about this too much because we're in America, but the class thing was so important to me that, you know, Lawrence, from this working class background, and for somebody like me, you know, he sort of felt like a sort of trailblazer, really, you know. Hmm. So important like that.
The occult connection I just am dying to ask you about is not with Lawrence, but with the writer still among us, still productive in a way, John Berger. Mm. You've edited his work. You've studied with him, I take it. You must be a friend. John Berger is not exactly a celebrity in this culture, but he surely is in the kind of higher pantheon of authoritative artists, art critic, but critic of art criticism, aesthete, magnetic man, incredibly precise writer, political conscience of the world up there with, I mean, he and Noam Chomsky go around the world looking to be provocative, to be outraged. I'd love you to speak about him and how you know him. And also, is that a biography someday?
Oh, that's interesting. I love this idea of John Berger as superhero, magnetic man. Why are we drawn to John Berger? God, you could have a whole seminar on John Berger. I mean,
whoa, I'll go when you do it.
Sure. So, I mean, for me, it was really, I mean, I liked the idea of being a writer when I left university. And back then, there was a straightforward choice, really, it seemed to me. Either you were a novelist, which meant you wrote novels, or you became a sort of critic in which you sort of wrote about other people's novels. Now, Berger and a number of other people that I was reading at that time, Roland Barthes, this is after I left university, they seemed to introduce this area where, you know, you could write criticism that was original, commentary that was kind of creative. And since I suffered from this not inconsiderable setback in terms of my ability to write novels and absolute inability to think of any stories, making available that kind of space really was really important, as you know, because it was something I wanted to do. The other things with Berger's work that were so important to me, I mean, the tendency of the educational process I went through in Britain was towards greater and greater specialization. You know, 8 O-levels, 3 A-levels, a degree in one subject, and then if you could discover somebody who'd not already been done to death by other PhD students, the sort of supreme pointlessness of a PhD, you know, finer and finer specialism. And Berger was exactly the opposite in that, you know, he was writing about lots of different kinds of things. But crucially, he wasn't just writing it on lots of different subjects, but always applying a uniform template to it. He was finding, you know, with each new subject he addressed, he would find some new way of doing it. Mm. So, you know, all of that was really, really, you know, liberating and enabling for me. And then there was something about Berger's political and moral authority, I guess, also. I guess, you know, I'd done English literature, and he provided a point, like as did Raymond Williams, at which that kind of education sort of linked up with a broader political outlook, really. You know, and to put it at the most basic level, you know, he made all those boring old paintings of men in ruffs look incredibly interesting. So he just opened my eyes like that. Okay, so that's all fine. And then we come to this very sort of familiar moment when I am able to meet this writer who I admired so much. And this is going to link up with something. Several people last week were quoting that line of Yeats's Perfection of the Man or the Work. And I think you all know there's a long history of the young, the young fan meeting the writer who he admires so much and turns out to have feet of clay. Mm. And I go to interview John Berger for Marxism Today. Huh, those were the days. you know, and this man, of course, he was unbelievably brilliant and was so, so kind. I mean, I've been interviewed a lot, and the idea is you do the interview and you're courteous, and then, you know, after the interview's over, you shut the door and you sort of go, phew, great, I've got the publicity as a result of that, and they've gone. and I know that also that the worst kind of thing you want is a young interviewer to come to interview you, do the interview, and then say at the end, actually, I'm a writer myself. Could you look at my... No, get out the door. You know. So anyway, I did this thing with Berger, and I said, you know, I'd like to be a... I'm a sort of young writer. And he said, oh, would you send me stuff? Would you let me see it? And, you know, back at this, I'm about sort of 24 or something like that. And, you know, this was the kind of the boom of the sort of yuppie era. And a lot of my friends, you know, they were owning property, they had jobs. And, you know, I was getting left behind as some sort of, you know, loser. And after we'd said this, done this interview, John Berger said to me, should we go to a pub now? So we go to this pub and... You know, and then I'm a rather fussy eater. I don't know if you, probably it doesn't even exist in America, it's so revolting. There's this thing called a Scotch egg. It's like a boiled egg, which is then fried. It's just a revolting thing. So we go to this pub, And John Berger says, oh, should we have a Scotch egg? You know, because he's sort of got this man of the people thing going. Anyway, and, you know, at that moment, I just so leapt ahead of my contemporaries because I was having a drink and a Scotch egg with this man that I loved so much, who, and this is the thing, you know, that he was so fantastic. And he realized, I mean, he was a sort of encourager and stuff. But I think both of us realize, there's a line of his, you know, which he says, you know, somewhere, you know, we can only learn from our equals. I mean, Berger has the most democratic outlook of anyone I've known. And I think he realized that it was a bore, it wasn't going to do me any good being a disciple. And for him, it was going to be a bore being a guru. So we sort of became friends, and he sort of encouraged me and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, the funny thing was, here was this most brilliant man, you know, but at the same time, and he's been such a, all of the qualities that my, you know, I grew up in this house without any books at all, but my parents put so much emphasis on kindness, reliability, punctuality. And, you know, John is, of all the people I know, you know, he's been as just so endlessly kind and gentle. And to go back to that Yeats thing, because after he'd done this sort of high modernist book, G, then he, you know, went to live among the French peasantry in the Haute Savoie and had to really, you know, relearn how to write. And he felt that there, living among these people, it was putting him in proximity to some of the sort of big issues in life. And I think he really, far from going for that either-or Yeats thing, I really think he's actually had to make sure that he's an exemplar, that his, not behavior, because that's just his being is as, you know, just as to be as good a person as possible to enable him to do the work. So several, just his kindness is incredible. One time I was living in Paris with my girlfriend and we got this letter. I recognized his handwriting. It was a package. It was all bloody. It was like the kind of thing you'd get from the mafia, you know, as a warning that next this thing is going to be you. So I open it, and he'd sent me 4 lamb chops through the post, which is a token both to his generosity and, I think you'll agree, the incredible efficiency of the French postal service. Totally fresh. And then, you know, I mean, just endless things like that. And also, I mean, the other thing which I think links Lawrence and Berger, which is so important. I mean, I think what was also, and sort of, if I can put myself in that thing, his hatred of England, I think. Mm. And it seems to me that in some ways he just sort of it's so difficult to live in England and not to end up just sinking into sort of depression, really. Mm. And, you know, and I think he sort of found a way out of that. And one of the things is that, I mean, I think there are several sort of secrets to being forever youthful. One is just endless generosity. I mean, his generosity, just giving of himself is incredible. Always being interested in new things. So this guy who is now 80, I guess he's 86, I mean, he's just always turning me on to new things. Mm. When my dad died, for example, at the sort of funeral, my dad was, I mean, A, he made it clear he didn't want a penny to be spent. He didn't want any religion. You know, it was a really pretty stripped down basic affair. And then, so he didn't know, you know, he had a few sort of, couldn't know what to, it would have been really appropriate to have any poetry readings. And then John called up and was so nice. And then, you know, I said about this, and then he called back and said, oh no, he's great, I just want to read you this poem by Janos Ritsos, you know, which I think your dad would have liked. Mm. And, you know, there's this beautiful poem by this, is he Greek, I think? Yeah, that I'd never, it was just, you know, so he's just so thoughtful like that. Mm. Now, it seems to me that if we go back to that Yeats, you know, perfection of the man or the work, okay, we were speaking last week, Naipaul couldn't care less if we think he's an unpleasant man, that he's acted like a dick, you know, and we love hearing anecdotes about Naipaul's appalling behaviour. Well, yeah, maybe, but I don't know. It seems to me that those sort of books like Gorillas and In a Free State, there's something, the flaws in those books derive, I think, perhaps, I don't think it's sentimental to say, they perhaps, it's linked to Naipaul's limitations as a person. And, you know, they're incredible, those books. I mean, you know, the racism in them makes the misogyny almost palatable. or vice versa, I forget. So it's been a while.
So many threads there I'd love to stretch out on and in what time we have. But one, I mean, this is one of the reasons I want to be you when I grow up, if I do. But it's simply this gift of reading that keeps broadening, not narrowing. Bob Richardson, in his wonderful book on Emerson, How First We Read, Then We Write, Emerson was eternally, this is pre-Google, obviously, pre-web, but he was always widening the scope of what interested him. Mm. And obviously, John Berger does, but so do you. First of all, you start with a huge sort of English school base of lines and writers and proportions and relationships that will stick with you forever, but then it keeps broadening. Teach us.
I mean, yeah, so I get what I want from a subject and then move on to something else. So, for example, for a while, when I was really interested in the First World War, you know, I read everything about the First World War. Now, I wasn't going to
then... There are libraries, there are mountains to read on the First World War.
Indeed, and that's another... To go back to the Lawrence point, you see, the fact that there were all these histories of the First World War freed me from having to do what one might call the date stuff. You know, I didn't need to talk about the... You know, I could just do my eccentric take on the First World War. And then, I guess, you know, since this book, The Missing of the Somme, and then, I mean, so then, you know, then I'd move on to something else. And weirdly, so it's... Yeah, I've just never been... I've liked the idea of these kind of quick sort of, you know, the Nietzsche thing, you know, what's his line where he says, you know, I treat philosophical... deep philosophical problems like a cold bath, you know, just in and out quickly. and, you know, so to go back to the First World War, and then part of that has always been, because I don't want to be thorough, because there's other people who can do the thorough stuff, the thorough stuff, you know, it leaves me just to develop, some, you know, that line of Deanne Arbus's, you know, when she says, you know, I don't do this, I don't do that, but then she says, but I think I've still got some little corner on things. So with the First World War, you know, I just had these, I didn't want to do a history book. No point, there's loads of history books. But I did have, you know, some sort of insight. And I had one insight which was of such genius that nobody had noticed it before, which I'll share with you because the book's out there, which was this, that I realized, I was the first person to spot this, that the thing about the First World War was that it took place in the past. Nobody had noticed that before me. That is to say that the weird thing was about the First World War, unlike the Second World War, even as it was being fought, people were so anxious about how it would be remembered. Hmm. You know, to give you a little example of that, since we're talking about writers, in our equivalent of Veterans Day, Armistice Day, you know, we intone this thing, you know, in the morning and in the evening and at the going down of the sun, we will remember them. So, of course, this was something written after the great calamity, after the huge death toll of the First World War. Then it turns out, when were these lines written? God, they were written in August 1914. For the Fallen was written before anybody had a chance to fall. So it was this weird sort of retrospect, you know, this strange sort of, all those books are talking about, right, from the start, you know, how is this going to be remembered? Nobody will remember this, and then they list all the things which, of course, we have remembered. Anyway, so I've always had kind of faith in the peculiarity. I've always felt that, you know, we all as writers want to arrive at some sort of universal truth, of course. And it's this strange wager, isn't it, whereby the chances of arriving at that universal truth are going to be greatly increased if you remain absolutely faithful to the vagaries of your own nature, the peculiarities and contingencies of one's own experience. So then, you know, with my weird sort of, one might say sort of idiotic, ridiculous take on the First World War, actually that means that people from all different parts of the world whose experiences have been so different to mine think, oh yeah, that rings true. And so similarly, when I wrote my sort of mad history of photography, you know, it turns out that, you know, quite a lot of, you know, people, although that was an eccentric history of photography, to say the least, it was one that quite a lot of people responded to, particularly, weirdly, the photographers, just as the first people to really like the jazz book.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just what I was thinking. So much ground to cover, and they're beginning to make wave at us over there that this game is approaching an end. But I got to ask you, because you mentioned John Berger on England. Ridiculous question, but whatever happened to England?
Yeah.
I mean, I look at, you know, David Cameron's politics. It's infinitely more boring than ours. The British commentary in this country, they seem all, yourself included, but in a different way, all these chattering class Brits, these late imperialists, like the worst of them is Neil Ferguson, I think. There are lots of others. Tony Blair is the kind of ultimate embodiment of them. Come over here and are coaching us to do our very worst in the world. What's going on over there?
I don't know, but I mean, what I could say about is this really that, you know, I come from this working class family the thing is that it wasn't a thing of me pulling myself up by my own bootstraps as a result of the post-war settlement. A load of mechanisms were put in place really to enable, you know...
Yeah, good ones too, right?
Good ones, oh yeah, of course, yeah. And, you know, so I was... What that meant is that, you know, really good quality, free
the Tony Judd agenda, basically.
Yes, exactly that. Yeah. You know, it was all in place, and so I just rode this educational escalator, which took me from this, you know, family to, to Oxford, all that kind of stuff. And... You know, there was loads of people. You know, it was a path that had been trodden by a lot of people before me. And after, and the tragedy of one of the many things wrong with. You know, there is now less social mobility in Britain than there was in the 1970s. And it's a desperate shame.
And of course, it's creeping here too, in the same pattern of upward mobility and. Decline of the social democracy that Tony Judd celebrated. Anyway, okay, that's a short answer. I just want to come back before we're done to jazz, which is important to me, but it seems to me it's somehow important to your method, your example, this improvisatory work that is, again, it has no stamp of any institution or approval. It doesn't even make money. It never much did, and yet it's something... In what sense can we still make jazz a sort of model of our learning, of our understanding, et cetera?
Oh, my. Well, I mean, you know, it was in terms of, it was one of the things when I was listening to jazz that I saw illustrated so clearly the way this, you know, idea that, you know, the evolving tradition of any art is a kind of, you know, enacts a kind of criticism. So, and you could see this so... clearly in the kind of, you know, just in the titles of jazz songs, you know, so, I'm trying to think now, you know, so Ellington writes Take the Coltrane for John Coltrane, and then, you know, Mingus writes Open Letter to Duke for Duke Ellington, the Art Ensemble of Chicago.
Bouncing with Bud, or...
You know, yeah, the Art Ensemble of Chicago do a song called Charlie M, and you see it. So that kind of thing of just the, the tradition commenting on itself all the time. I mean, for somebody like me, coming from a literary background, the other thing was that these figures, you know, there's always the problem with writing about writers. Okay, they can be in the bar in Iowa City getting really drunk and fighting, blah blah blah. But then we get back to the thing that Blake so brilliantly described, the you know, Richard Yates in his room. You know, I know how writers write. You know, you just sit there going like that, you know, or like that or something. But there are these people, this mysterious thing of making music, and while they were doing their art thing, of course, that was sort of full of adventures and all this kind of stuff. And there was a weird thing with jazz, because of all, a peculiar thing about jazz, they had this weird status. On the one hand, they weren't superstars who were removed, who you couldn't get access to, you know, in the way that you can't now couldn't get access to sort of rock stars. But at the same time, there were these mythic... You know, there were these mythic figures and legendary things would be happening to them. So a weird sort of combination of familiarity and, yeah, of mythicness. And this was brought home to me so clearly in the... God, it's funny, I keep coming back to sort of things that Blake Bailey said. So, his story about Charlie Jackson in the meeting somebody in the urinal at the Village Vanguard in New York, you know, one of these mythic places where, you know, the guy will show you the Mingus light, the light that Mingus smashed up in one of his many rages. You know, I found myself standing in the urinal next to Charlie Hayden. Charlie frigging Hayden, you know. There he was. I mean, I thought, do we shake hands or probably not? But, you know, so there it is, that sort of weird combination of, intimacy is not the right word, proximity, and, you know, it was somebody with such a deep connection to the jazz tradition. You know, you meet Charlie Hayden, or you stand next to him in the toilet, and there you are. You know, it's a direct in 2 degrees of separation, you're back to the absolute heart of the jazz tradition. And then, you know, I mean, you can listen on the internet to Don Cherry talking about the first time he met Albert Eiler, and Cherry in his lovely voice says, I was there in Copenhagen, I was playing with Sonny Rollins and Dexter Gordon. And that's when I first met, this is just incredible stuff. It's stuff of a kind of, on a religious scale. Hey,
amen.
You know?
Hey, amen.
Did you just say, hey, man? Yeah, man.
Well,
what did you say, amen?
I said amen. But no, it's funny, we were speaking about this earlier, interviewing Sonny Rollins, and again, you're just overwhelmed that this man is 2 feet away, and then he's warm, and he liked me. He ended up calling me the voice. He was sweet. He writes to me now and then. But anyway, I said we're going to play some of your music, and he said, I'd rather be in Abu Ghraib than hear my own music again.
Yeah.
And I said, well, we're going to play it anyway. And then we played a recording, Dizzy Gillespie put it together, of, it was called Sunny Side Up, Sonny Rollins and Sonny Stitt. A genius, sort of overshadowed in many ways by Parker, played the tenor saxophone. But anyway, Sonny Rollins practically collapsed, like you next to Charlie Hayden. He said, I can't believe I played that music with Sonny Stitt. He felt as blessed, as, you know, overwhelmed as you did standing to Charlie Hayden. Last question for me, if we have one moment. Are you an American writer yet?
Oh, that's a good
Are you an American
question.
Yet, but are you an American writer yet, too?
That is a good question. I'll try to answer it very, very briefly. I mean, I sort of think of my... it's funny. I suppose the short answer is no. This was brought home to me when the last book, the Tarkovsky book, that was, the whole copy editing process was done in America. And, you know, it's fine, because I feel I write... I don't want to think of myself as an English writer. I mean, that seems to me a really... smaller thing to be than an American writer, you know. And then it came back and it had all been Americanized, the spelling and the punctuation, and just those small changes, it came back, it didn't sound like me. So I'm afraid I've got to suck it up and say, when I was growing up, you know, there's all this talk about these writers, you know, Timothy Moe, who was sort of Anglo-Chinese, Katsuyoshi Gru, Anglo-Japanese, and, you know, there was I, sort of Anglo-English. I sort of accept that I'm sort of Anglo-English. Yeah.
It sounds like, I hope I don't misquote it, Robert Frost's poem on New Hampshire, and the last line is, at present I am living in Vermont. Jeff Dyer, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with Jeff Dyer, with help from Arlo Haskell and the fine staff of the Key West Literary Seminar. The game isn't over until listeners, that's you, post your comments on our website, radioopensource.org. Thank you for being part of the conversation.